You know, the total mapping of this relationship between accidents and socialization was something that I could trace because I could use the statistics when it is divided by sex.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
So the first big work I did was sex, roles, and accidents.
Berit Ås, you are from where?
Norway, from Oslo, where I live, and I'm a mother of four kids. I'm 74 years old. When I'm 75, I'll stop traveling and start writing. But I have been teaching almost all my life, mostly at the University of Oslo Social Science, and my main areas have been accident research, consumer economy, and women's studies. I am the starter of a feminist university in Norway, which has been going on for about 20 years. I have been suspended from the Labour Party and asked by the Steel Union to make my own party, which I did in 73. And that was called the Democratic Socialists. And after 2 years, we went together with a series of other groups, feminist, ecologist, Women's People's Party, into a bigger party, the Socialist Left. And I was elected the first leader of that party, too. So I've been in politics. I've been in the Committee of Foreign Affairs, and there I have been suggesting the quota system that we should be an equal amount of men and women in the parliament. I mean, changing the constitution and so on. And I think that is most of my background. I've been teaching as a visiting professor in Manila, Columbia, Missouri, Halifax, Canada, Uppsala, Sweden. I am very privileged too, because I've had this opportunity to travel around and see how women's conditions really are. And in the consumer economy, I was from the first time in the 60s concerned about how poverty develops. So I'm very, very, very interested in this horrible globalization of the finances.
Your specialty, or one of your specialties, is statistics. And because I have very few chances to talk to feminists who really know statistics and have worked with them, I wanted to ask you some questions about that. Tell me about how you got into the field of statistics and one of your early studies that involved gender disaggregated statistics.
I got into it. I did my graduate work in Michigan, Ann Arbor. And if you go into social science, it's very important to know your figures. You know, Mao said it too. The first thing in the revolution is to know your figures. You must know who you are, what group you belong to, the size of the poverty, all these kind of things. So I had a course in statistics from home, from Oslo. But then I took advanced statistics. In fact, I think it was obligatory for my graduate work. But anyhow, it didn't come to use until I came home. And I wanted at that early time to, what I said, map the Norwegian feminist society or women's society out of eight categories, which I thought was very, very important. And then all of the fund makers, they laughed and they said, "Are you crazy, Mrs. Ås? This is Women's Lib. We are not going to give any money to Women's Lib." So I was too early. But they looked at my papers and said, "But it looks like if you are quite capable, we don't have a person to do the accident research in Norway. So would you please be the Norwegian accident researcher?" And okay, that was the only option I had. So I said yes, but I got very angry. So I thought I would play them a trick back. So the first big work I did was sex, roles, and accidents. But it wasn't only to give some revenge. It was because in the socialization of the sexes, you have a series of studies and much literature on criminality and sex roles, on alcoholism and sex, on suicide and sex, on violence and sex. And the thing is that all these areas, they start with grown-ups. So, of course, the question could arise, how does it develop from the birth and into those kind of horrible figures that I had in front of me, which said that when it came to really heavy alcoholics, at that time it was about only 10% women and 90% men. When it came to murders and all kinds of criminal acts, it was about the same division. When it came to suicides, it was 25% women and 75% men. And when it came to accidents, women had about a third. So how does it really start? So the very funny thing about accident research is that in the statistics, you register the accidents from the first day of people's lives. So when you go into that kind of statistics, you find a very funny kind of development, because boys and girls are even 50% when they are born in all countries except India and Sri Lanka. And then you just go down to the age between 10 and 15, and then there are 7 times as many boys who die from accident than girls. So it is a falling curve if you look at the girl statistics. And it falls still further down from 20 years and up to 40 years. It's very, very low. And then it's not until you get 70 years old that you have the same proportion of accidents in the two sexes in relation to their representations in the society. So my students very often cry out when I come to that part of the curve, oh, all the courageous men are then dead, you know. And this has some kind of truth in it. And you go to the popular opinion and they said, oh, you see, men, they are working in such dangerous situations. So that's the reason why they die off. Well, so I divided the accidents of men into free time and working time. And the curves look exactly similar. Men decide to die wherever they are to a such much more greater extent than women. So the thing is, where to go? I went into language, and language solved a series of problems for me, because language is really a killer. The adjectives are killing, because from the very first time almost, boys are supposed to be courageous, strong, self-reliant, making decisions fast, being heroes. And they are seen like that already in the crib. So fathers and mothers are much more, they aren't careful with the boys because the boys are so strong, but they are extremely more careful with small girls. Except in Sri Lanka and India. But the thing is, when you start socializing the child, they come to know very fast that boys are courageous, that they are strong. And where do you have to go to show that you are a boy? You have to go into a dangerous situations. And dangerous situation is everywhere, if you are looking for it. You can climb, you can do all kinds of funny things. In one place I found 25 people who had almost died in accident happenings, and 24 of them were men, and those men, they were having races with their wheelchairs in the corridors. So I put up the, I think it was the 20 most accident loaded activities. And it's really from walking down steps, which kills older people, to hanging on the back of trailers and so on. And then swimming far from land and jumping on skis and all these kind of things. And I just asked boys and girls, how dangerous is it? And I made a scale of four steps, from least dangerous to the most dangerous. And then you can also divide it up on the sexes. And then you see a very funny thing. You see that for the boys, the slope is much further down, while the girls' slope is much steeper. So the more dangerous a situation is, the bigger difference is it between the boys' and the girls' evaluation of how dangerous it is. Then I went further and I asked a big group of girls and boys from 11 to 13 years in the school, what is really most boyish and what is most girlish? And that was a very well developed test, taking again a series of adjectives, like being strong, being clumsy, being afraid, being nervous, being law-abiding, doing what your parents says, all these kind of things. Again, you could rank them, what was most boyish and most girlish. And then I had a 10-point scale. And all these kids agreed. And remember now, at this is a time when the girls are half a head higher than boys. They are heavier, they are stronger. And everybody agrees that boy are the strongest. So that is on the far end of the 10-point scale. And who are most nervous? That's girls. Nervous, afraid, cautious, helpful, follow traffic rules most. And boys are courageous, self-reliant, fast thinking when it comes to doing decisions, strongest. And it's a beautiful curve. And when you divide it up again in boys' and girls' opinions, the difference isn't very big. The only thing is that adjectives which has a kind of a negative connotations is a little more pushed away from each of the sexes when it is ascribed to them. And good adjectives goes to themselves. But the thing is that then this is the opinions. I again went into the child's real life. And I made a test, and this is the same population I'm working with all the whole time. I asked them how many accidents they had had up to this age. I had to then select accidents which was so big that they would remember. Have you ever broken your arm? If you have, how many times? Have you ever broken a leg? If you have, how many times? Have you ever cut yourself so that you have to go to the doctor and been sewn? Have you ever burnt yourself? Have you ever lost a tooth? You know, it was that size of accidents. When I looked at my distribution, the total amount of accidents that the boys had had was 17, and the total amount of accidents that the girls' group have had was 7. But I was not interested in that. I was interested in the theory about accidents. There are two different kind of opinions in the theory of psychology about what will happen if you have had one accident. Learning hypothesis is that if a person have had an accident, that person has learned to take care of himself or herself in a similar situation next time. You see? And then you have a theory about accident proneness. That theory stems from as early as 1926 in Germany. A German statistician found that if he was comparing persons who had had one accident with persons who had none accidents, the one who had had one accident were more apt to have another one. And the same thing if you had two accidents and zero accidents and so on. So it was a cumulative curve. So this accident proneness thesis is one that has almost been accepted totally by psychologists. But the thing was that he didn't differentiate between men and women. So what I did was that I was looking after what you could call accident-prone children. This isn't very specific, but I was cutting off, you know, you have the distribution when you have accidents. There are very many of girls who have 3 or 4 accidents. Few have 7, and few has 0. It's a little skewed, by the way, this distribution. But anyhow, and for the boys, you have almost similar things, but you have a much flatter curve in the upper area. But anyway, I cut off the tails of those distribution, and that meant that I had kids that seemed to be very secure, both among boys and girls. And I had kids that seemed to have be very insecure, I mean, accident prone in a way. So I really looked for how these two hypotheses would come out if I took those two groups, the boys and the girls, and I just looked at what their evaluation of dangers was. So I found that the boys with many more accidents, they had a lower estimate of the danger of the situation. And you remember these two curves about how dangerous things are? So they had still a lower slope than the boys. Then I asked the girls who had had lots of accidents, because if the accident-prone hypothesis is true, the girls would also be lower in their estimate of the danger if they have had many accidents. But that went the other way. They had a higher estimate of how dangerous things were. So it seemed that the accident proneness hypothesis could be applied to the boys, because the more accident they had, the lower did they estimate the danger. And you can think of this in two ways. The one is, oh, I was happy, I didn't die, I only broke an arm. This kind of psychological treatment of their experience. Or you could say, this is more psychoanalytic, I know that I will be pressured to do these things again. I better repress my anxiety. And then I come out and I evaluate those activities as less dangerous. For the girls, they don't have to live up as a big group, tomboys perhaps, among girls, but they don't have to live up to those expectations of being courageous, strong, and all the time. They are asked to be careful. So the thing is that it doesn't cost them anything to be a little afraid and to then estimate the danger as higher than those who hadn't experienced these kind of accidents in their lives. I got very curious about this, because suddenly two things appeared to me. Psychologists, they said, if a child or a person had been in an accident, you had to treat their kind of psychology in this and this and this way. But they lump both men and women together. So I was questioning very strongly if a girl who had had an accident should be treated psychologically in different ways. But it really comes out in the men's favor, because they have so many accidents. So psychologists don't see the small deviations that comes up if you look at men and women differently. So I looked at accident research for pilots in war and all these kind of things. But the thing is that was interesting, there are mass research on men and women in the workplaces and how much accidents they have. And I remember it was a big industrial research made in 1954, and that was thousands and thousands of workers in the USA. And then they had for once divided between men and women, and they found exactly that if a person had had one accident, the relationship was 1 to 2. For every 2 accidents a man had, it was only 1 for women. Then if you took out the population that had 2 accidents, the relation was 1 to 3. For every 3 accidents the man had, it was only 1 in the women's group. And if you went over that up to 3 accidents and more, the relationship was 1 to 7. From that, I went into some industrial work and I looked at tram drivers. And there it was. The women tram drivers in Norway who had just been accepted, that they had no accidents. The men had very many accidents. I went to a shipyard and looked at the accident rate of women and men who was driving the big cranes. No accidents among women, very many accidents among men. that meant that in work, in the workplace, women are much more safe. They take care of much more material. They are not so expensive that men are. So then I met the wall. It was almost that they said, oh, is that the way that the women are going to take all their jobs away from us? So that was the first wall. The second wall was in another era, that was in traffic security. When in some way traffic accidents, which you have, they say, it starts out with a heavy load in the first year of driving, and after 7 years of driving, you have the lowest amount of accident in the driving population. But again, I said, this is the total. What about men and women? And of course, already early, the Americans who had the car coming up so fast, they knew that the men and women between 18 and 24 had a very different kind of accident rate. It was so different that I think that the men had to pay four times as high premiums. But how did it look like in the layman's heads? There, the women were the really bad driver. So you could see when you went through motor journals and so on, this picture about these women in big hats who stopped in the traffic and looked into a boutique with hats, or just stopping in a crossing and rolling down the window and having a chat with a women chauffeur that came the other way. Or they were just driving down all kinds of fences, backing, you know, the popular kind of discrimination of women as bad drivers in a certain period was absolutely horrible. And that was in the same time the Swedes divided up young drivers in men and women. And they found out that young women were the safest drivers you could think of. But I really have the suspicion that not many years after, they started in the Statistics Central Bureau to discuss if really it was any reason of dividing up the accidents in men and women. So I don't know what they have done now, but to not have different statistics on men and women, that hides both poverty development and it hides sickness, it hides the conditions of women, you know. So we don't have enough statistics on where, do, for instance, the battered women came from. Remember, this is the end of the 60s. I worked in that area about 12 years. Now we know very much more about how dangerous it is for a woman to be in a family situation compared to out in the streets, and we know who is battered and so on. We still have lots of statistics in the shadow. And the interesting thing is that when you start to use statistics in that way, then you find out that in some way the statistics should be loaded from other kinds of questions. You don't ask the right questions because statistics are developed in a male society. And that statistics means that you are asking questions that are relevant for men and interesting for men. And very many of the descriptive statistical works are then not there because you haven't really scrutinized women. Is that what it's called? To ask them, what do we really need about women's condition and your experiences? And I am absolutely sure that the way that we see the world and evaluate the world and interpret the world is so different. And that's where one of the language questions comes in, that the questions which you use for make the statistics is phrased in the wrong way, so that you don't get the kind of right conditions of women described.
What are some of the areas in which you think we should be gathering statistics, or some of the kinds of questions that we should be asking that are not generally being asked statistically?
Yeah, first of all, I'm now very interested in low-dose radiation and its health effects. And I've been working on that for 20 years now. And what I find is that when you have a nuclear station accident, for instance, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and so on, you only count the immediate deaths. and you get an absolutely false kind of picture. In Chernobyl, Norway is nearer to Chernobyl than America is, and we were told that it only was a third in death accidents. And then they stop, and it's very political, because after about 10 years, we found that a million Russian soldiers either had died or were sick from cancer or leukemia. So you have a curve that is very high in the beginning, and then it drops. And that's what the people who are interested in developing nuclear power and depleted uranium weapon and so on, they refer to that. While, in fact, you should have statistics that shows that half the population of the children in Ukraine are now sick. Now it has come up, the veterans from the Gulf War, of course. But again, they were cheated. They were lied to. They said that this is a kind of psychiatric syndrome. Until the symptoms were so clearly one that came from radiation, but low radiation doses.
So you're saying the Gulf War illness is clearly a radiation sickness?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That was the first time they really tried out depleted uranium. And you know, the thing is, I'm also interested in peace research. I should have mentioned that. So in the Gulf War, they found out that if you coated the tanks with depleted uranium, shells from the enemy wouldn't go through. And you have a man who is sitting in the tanks in the tower, not well shielded. So they put vests on them that had depleted uranium. This is the big discussion in my little area of the world. And it's obviously that the military forces, the production firms, and also I think the WHO, which is headed by our own prime minister, they are in some way saying that depleted uranium is not dangerous at all. So I don't know, but the kind of important thing is that you should have independent feminist statisticians who really went into all these areas where things are hidden for us. And when we either are lied to, or men are not asking women the right question for the statistics because they don't know how women are seeing the world.
So if women who are listening to this want to learn more about statistics and how to use them, can they learn this at the Feminist University in Norway from you?
Unfortunately. And we go in that direction, but it isn't that analytical. The thing is that we have been establishing a new foundation called the International Feminist University Network. And we have gotten some money, and this foundation is located in Treviso in Italy. And we are working now on the areas that we should cover. And I think what you ask me is, perhaps, I never thought about it before, we should have a special department for developing feminist statistics, which is statistics that could really improve women's life or change the bad direction that it goes when it comes both to poverty and sickness and so on.
Thank you, Berit Aas. That's Beritas. What's
with
the name
ring,
of...
With a ring over the A.
Aas, Berit Aas. Reporting for Wings, I'm Frieda Worden. To contact Wings, our email is wings@wings.org. Website, www.wings.org. The Wings sound logo is from Livana's album, A Circle Is Cast. Special thanks to Suzette Cullen and to Genevieve Vaughn, author of 36 Steps to a Gift Economy. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.